torturing either of us that much harder. I had no doubt that Æthelhelm the Younger had committed treason by hiring Welsh troops to kill his nephew's rival, but it made no sense that he would have persuaded the monk to tell me the lies that had brought me across Britain to Chester. Beneath us, on the arena's floor, the first prisoner died. A stroke of a sword, a severed head and blood. So much blood. Æthelstan's revenge had started. Not every prisoner died. Æthelstan showed more sense than that. He killed those men he judged to be close to Kinlaf, but spared the youngest. 33 men died, all put to the sword, and I remembered a day when I had handed Æthelstan my sword and told him to kill a man. Æthelstan had been a boy with an unbroken voice, but I was training him to be a king. I had captured Eardwulf, also a rebel. It had happened not far from Chester, beside a ditch, and I had beaten Eardwulf down so that he lay half-stunned in the scummy water. "Make it quick, boy," I had told Æthelstan. He had not killed before, but a boy must learn these skills, and a boy who would be king must learn to take life. I thought about that day as I watched Kinlaf's men die. All had been stripped of their mail, stripped of anything of value. They shivered as, one by one, they were led to their deaths. Æthelstan must have remembered that distant day, too, because he used his youngest warriors as his executioners, doubtless wanting them to learn the lesson he had learned beside that ditch, that killing a man is hard. Killing a helpless man with a sword takes resolve. You look into their eyes, see their fear, smell it, too. And a man's neck is tough. Few of the 33 died cleanly. Some were hacked to death, and the old arena smelled as it must have smelled when the Romans filled the tiered seats and cheered the men fighting on the sand below. A stink of blood, shit, and piss. Æthelstan had killed Eardwulf quickly enough. He had not tried to hack off the rebel's head, but had instead used serpent breath to cut Eardwulf's throat, and I had watched the ditch turn red. And Eardwulf had been Edith's brother, and Edith was now my wife. Kinlaf died last. I thought Æthelstan might kill the rebel leader himself, but instead he summoned his servant, a boy who would grow to be a warrior, and gave him the sword. Kinlaf's hands were bound, and he had been forced to his knees. "Do it, boy," Æthelstan ordered, and I saw the youngster close his eyes as he swung the sword. He slammed the edge into Kinlaf's skull, knocking him sideways and drawing blood, but Kinlaf had hardly been hurt. His left ear was sliced open, but the boy's blow had lacked force. A priest, there were always priests with Æthelstan, raised his voice as he chanted a prayer. "Swing again, lad," Æthelstan said. "And keep your eyes open," I shouted. It took 7 blows to kill Kinlaf. Those of his men whom Æthelstan had spared would swear new oaths to a new lord. They would be Æthelstan's men. So the rebellion was defeated, at least in this part of Mercia. The feared, dragged from their fields and flocks, had gone to their homes, leaving only melting snow, the ashes of campfires, and Griffith's Welshmen who waited beside Kinlaf's tents. "He calls himself a king," I told Æthelstan as we walked towards the tents.
"Kingship comes from God," Æthelstan said.
I was surprised by that response. I had merely been trying to amuse him, but Æthelstan was in a grim mood after the killings.
"He should have told us he was a king last night," he said disapprovingly.
"He was in a humble mood," I said, "and wanted a favour. Besides, he's probably king of 3 dung-heaps, a ditch and a midden, nothing more."
"I still owe him respect. He's a Christian king."
"He's a mucky Welsh chieftain," I said. who calls himself a king until someone who owns two more dung heaps than he does comes and slices his head off. And he'd slice your head off, too, if he could. You can't trust the Welsh.
I didn't say I trusted him, merely that I respect him. God endows men with kingship, even in Wales.
And to my horror, Æthelstan stopped a few paces from Griffith and bowed his head.
"Lord King," he said.
Griffith liked the gesture and grinned. He also saw his son, who was still guarded by Folkwold and Oswy. He said something in Welsh that none of us understood.
"Griffith of Gwent begs you to release his son, Lord Prince,"
Father Bledod translated.
"He agreed to give us a name first," Æthelstan said, "and his chain, and a pledge that he will keep the peace for a year."
Griffith must have understood Æthelstan's words, because he immediately took the gold links from around his neck, handed them to Bledod, who in turn gave them to Æthelstan, who immediately handed the chain to Father Swithred. Then Griffith began telling a tale that Father Bledod did his best to interpret even as it was being told. It was a long tale, but the gist of it was that a priest had come from Mercia to talk with King Arthful of Gwent, and an agreement had been made, gold had been given, and Arthful had summoned his kinsman, Griffith, and ordered him to take his best warriors north to Chester.
"The king,"
Æthelstan interrupted at one point,
"says the priest came from Mercia."
That provoked a hurried discussion in Welsh.
"The priest offered us gold," Father Bledod told Æthelstan. "Good gold! Enough gold to fill a helmet, Lord Prince, and to earn it we simply had to come here to fight."
"I asked if the priest was from Mercia," Æthelstan insisted.
"He was from the Sais,"
Bledod said.
"So he could have been a West Saxon?" I asked.
"He could, Lord,"
Bledod said unhelpfully.
"And the name of the priest?"
Æthelstan demanded.
"Stigand, Lord."
Æthelstan turned and looked at me, but I shook my head. I had never heard of a priest named Stigand.
"But I doubt the priest used his own name," I said.
"So we'll never know,"
Æthelstan said bleakly. Griffith was still speaking, indignant now. Father Bledod listened, then looked embarrassed.
"Father Stigand is dead, Lord Prince."
"Dead?" Æthelstan exclaimed.
"On his way home from Gwent, Lord Prince, he was waylaid. King Griffith says he's not to blame. Why would he kill a man who might bring him more Sais gold?"
"Why, indeed?" Æthelstan asked.
Had he expected to hear his enemy's name? That was naive. He knew as well as I did that Æthelhelm the Younger was the likely culprit. But Æthelhelm was no fool and would have taken care to conceal the treachery of hiring men to fight against his own king. So the man who had negotiated with Arthfail of Gwent was dead, and the dead take their secrets to the grave.
"Lord Prince,"
Bledod asked nervously,
"the king's son?"
"Tell King Griffith of Gwent," Æthelstan said, "that he may have his son."
"Thank you,"
Bledod began.
"And tell him," Æthelstan interrupted, "that if he fights again for men who rebel against my father's throne, then I will lead an army into Gwent, and I will lay Gwent waste and turn it into a land of death."
"I will tell him, Lord Prince,"
Bledod said, though none of us who were listening believed to one heartbeat that the threat would be translated.
"Then go,"
Æthelstan commanded. The Welshman left. The sun was higher now, melting the snow, though it was still cold. A blustery wind came from the east to lift the banners hanging from Chester's walls. I had crossed Britain to rescue a man who did not need rescuing. I had been tricked. But by whom? And why? I had another enemy. A secret enemy. and I had danced to his drumbeat. Weird Bith Ful Arad. Chapter 3. The next day dawned bright and cold, the pale sky only discoloured by smoke from the fires as Æthelstan's men burned the remnants of Kinlaf's encampment. Finan and I, mounted on horses captured from the rebels, rode slowly through the destruction.
"When do we leave?" Finan asked.
"As soon as we can.
The horses could do with a rest.
Maybe tomorrow, then."
"That soon?"
"I'm worried about Bebbanburg," I confessed. "Why else would someone drag me across Britain?"
"Bebbanburg's safe," Finan insisted. "I still think it was Æthelhelm who tricked you."
"Hoping I'd be killed here?"
"What else? He can't kill you while you're inside Bebbanburg, so he has to get you outside the wall somehow."
"I spend enough time with Stiora and her children," I pointed out. "My daughter, Queen of Northumbria, lived in Iofawick's rambling palace, which was a mix of Roman grandeur and solid timber halls."
"He can't reach you in Iofawick either.
He wanted you out of Northumbria."
"Maybe you're right," I said, unconvinced.
"I'm always right.
I'm from Ireland. I was right about the snow, wasn't I? And I'm still waiting for the 2 shillings.
"You're a Christian. Patience is one of your virtues."
"I must be a living saint, then."
He looked past me. "And talking of saints..."
I twisted in the saddle to see Father Swithrid approaching. The priest was mounted on a fine grey stallion that he rode well, calming the beast when it shied sideways as a man threw an armful of dirty thatch onto a fire. Smoke billowed and sparks flew. Father Swithrid rode through the smoke and curbed the stallion near us.
"The prince," he said brusquely, "requests your company today."
"Requests or requires?" I asked.
"It's the same thing,"
Swithrid said and turned his horse, beckoning us to follow him.
I stayed where I was and held out a hand to check Finan.
"Tell me," I called after Swithrid,
"you're a West Saxon?"
"You know I am,"
he said, turning back suspiciously.
"Do you give orders to West Saxon eldermen?"
He looked angry, but had the sense to suppress the fury.
"The prince requests your company,"
he paused.
"Lord."
"Back in the city?"
"He's waiting at the north gate,"
Swithrid said curtly.
"We're riding to Brunanburh."
I spurred my horse alongside the priest's grey. "I remember the day I first met you, priest," I said, "and Prince Æthelstan told me he didn't trust you." He looked shocked at that.
"I cannot believe,"
he began to protest.
"Why would I lie?"
I interrupted him.
"I am devoted to the prince," he said forcefully.
"You were his father's choice, not his."
"And does that matter?"
he asked. I deliberately did not answer, but just waited until, reluctantly, he added,
"Lord?"
"The priests," I said, "write letters and read letters. Prince Æthelstan believed you were imposed on him to report back to his father."
"And so I was," Swithrid admitted. "And I will tell you precisely what I report to the king. I tell him his eldest son is no bastard. That he is a good servant of Christ, that he is devoted to his father, and that he prays for his father. Why do you think his father trusts him with the command of Chester?"
He spoke passionately.
"Do you know a monk called Brother Osric?" I asked suddenly.
Swithrid gave me a pitying look. He knew I had tried to trap him.
"No, Lord,"
he said, giving the last word a sour taste. I tried another question.
"So Æthelstan should be the next king of Wessex?"
"That is not my decision. God appoints kings."
"And is your God helped in his choice by wealthy eldermen?"
He knew I meant Æthelhelm the Younger. It had occurred to me that Swithrid might be sending messages to Æthelhelm. I had no doubt that the Elderman sought news of Ethelstan and probably had at least one sworn follower somewhere in Chester, and I was tempted to think it must be Swithrid, because the stern, bald priest disliked me so much, but his next words surprised me.
"It's my belief," he said, "that Lord Æthelhelm persuaded the king to give this command to the prince."
"Why?"
"So he would fail, of course. The prince has 3 burghs to command, Chester, Bramber, and Manchester, and not sufficient men to garrison even one of them properly. He has rebels to contend with, and thousands of Norse settlers north of here. Dear God! He even has Norsemen settled on this peninsula!"
I could not hide my astonishment. "Here? On Wir Helum?" Swithridge shrugged.
"You know what's been happening on this coast. The Irish defeated the Norse settlers, drove many of them out, and so they came here."
He gestured northwards.
"Out beyond Brunanburh? There might be 500 Norse settlers there, and even more north of the Mersey, and thousands more north of the Ribble."
"Thousands?" I asked. Of course, I had heard stories of the Norse fleeing Ireland, but thought most had found refuge in the islands off the Scottish coast, or in the wild valleys of Cumberland.
"The prince is letting his enemies settle on Mercian land.
Pagan enemies?"
"We have small choice," Swithrid said calmly. "King Edward conquered East Anglia. Now he's king of Mercia, and he needs all his troops to put down unrest and to garrison the new burghs he's making. He doesn't have the men to fight every enemy, and these Norsemen are too numerous to fight. Besides, they're beaten men. They were defeated by the Irish, they lost much of their wealth and many of their warriors in those defeats, and they crave peace. That's why they've submitted to us."
"For now," I said sourly. "Did any of them join Kinlaf?"
"Not one. Ingelmunda could have led his men against us, or he could have attacked Brunanburh. He did neither. Instead, he kept his men at home."
"Ingelmunda?" I asked.
"A Norseman," Swithrid said dismissively. "He's the chieftain who holds land beyond Brunanburh."
I found it difficult to believe that Norse invaders had been allowed to settle so close to Brunanburh and Chester. King Edward's ambition, which was the same as his father King Alfred's, was to drive the pagan foreigners out of Saxon territory, yet here they were on Chester's doorstep. I supposed that ever since Æthelflaed's death, there had been no stable government in Mercia. Kinlaf's rebellion was proof of that, and the Northmen were ever ready to take advantage of Saxon weakness. "Ingelmunda," I said forcefully, "whoever he is, might not have marched against you, but he could have come to your relief."
"The prince sent word that he was to do no such thing. We had no need of help, and we certainly had no need of pagan help."
"Even my help?" The priest turned to me with a ferocious expression.
"If a pagan wins our battles," he said vehemently, "then it suggests the pagan gods must have power. We must have faith. We must fight in the belief that Christ is sufficient."
I had nothing to say to that. The men who fought for me worshipped a dozen gods and goddesses, the Christian God among them, but if a man believes the nonsense that there is only one God, then there's no point in arguing, because it would be like discussing a rainbow with a blind man. We had ridden to the north of the city, where Æthelstan and a score of armed riders waited for us. Æthelstan greeted me cheerfully.
"The sun's shining, the rebels are gone, and God is good."
"And the rebels didn't attack Brunanburh?"
"So far as we know, that's what we're going to find out."
For almost as long as I could remember, Chester had been the most northerly burgh in Mercia. But Æthelflaed had built Brunanburh, just a few miles north and west, to guard the River Mersey. Brunanburh was a timber-walled fort, close enough to the river to protect a wooden wharf where warships could be kept. The purpose of the fort was to prevent Norsemen rowing up the Mersey, but if Swithrid was right, then all the land beyond Brunanburh, between the Dee and the Mersey, was now settled by pagan Norse.
"'Tell me about Ingilmunder,' I demanded of Æthelstan as we rode. I had asked the question in a truculent tone, but Æthelstan answered enthusiastically. "'I like him.'
"'A pagan?'
He laughed at that.
"'I like you too, Lord,' he said. "'Sometimes.'
He spurred his horse off the road and onto a track that skirted the Roman cemetery. He glanced at the weather-worn graves and made the sign of the cross.
Ingilmunder's father held land in Ireland. He and his men got beaten and driven to the sea. The father died, but Ingilmunder managed to bring off half his army with their families. I sent a message early this morning asking that he should meet us at Brunanburh because I want you to meet him. You'll like him too.
"'I probably will,' I said. "'He's a Norseman and a pagan. "'But that makes him your enemy, and he's an enemy living on your land. "'And he pays us tribute, and tribute weakens the payer and acknowledges his subservience.'
"'Cheaper in the long run,' I said, "'just to kill the bastards.'
"'Ingilmunder swore on his gods to live peaceably with us,' "'Æthelstan continued, ignoring my comment. "'I leapt on his words.'
So you trust his gods? You accept they are real?
They're real to Ingilmunder, I suppose, Æthelstan said calmly. Why make him take an oath on a god he doesn't believe in? That just begs for the oath to be broken.
I grunted at that. He was right, of course. But no doubt part of the agreement, I said scathingly, was that Ingilmunder accepts your damned missionaries.
"'The damned missionaries are indeed part of the agreement,' he said patiently. "'We insist on that with every Norseman who settles south of the Ribble. "'That's why my father put a burr at Manchester.'
"'To protect missionaries?' I asked, astonished.
"'To protect anyone who accepts mercy and rule,' he said, still patient, "'and punish anyone who breaks our law.' The warriors protect our land, and the monks and priests teach folk about God and about God's law. I'm building a convent there now.
That will terrify the Northmen, I said sourly.
It will help bring Christian charity to a troubled land, Æthelstan retorted.
His aunt, the Lady Æthelflaed, had always claimed the River Ribble as Mercia's northern frontier, though in truth... The land between the Mersey and the Ribble was wild and mostly ungoverned, its coast long settled by Danes, who had often raided the rich farmlands around Chester. I had led plenty of warbands north in revenge for those raids, once leading my men as far as Manchester, an old Roman fort on a sandstone hill beside the River Madlack. King Edward had strengthened those old walls and put a garrison into Manchester's fort. And thus, I reflected, the frontier of Mercia crept ever northwards. Chester had been the northernmost burr, then Brunanburh, and now it was Manchester. And that new burr on its sandstone hill was perilously close to my homeland, Northumbria.
"'Have you ever been to Manchester?'
Æthelstan asked me. "'I was there less than a week ago,' I said ruefully. The damned monk who lied to me left us at Manchester.
You came that way?
Because I thought the garrison would have news of you, but the bastards wouldn't talk to me, wouldn't even let us through the gate. They let the damned monk in, but not us.
Æthelstan laughed. That was Tredian.
Tredian?
A West Saxon. He commands there. Did he know it was you?
Of course he did. Æthelstan shrugged.
You're a pagan and a Northumbrian, and that makes you an enemy. Tredian probably thought you were planning to slaughter his garrison. He's a cautious man, Tredian. Too cautious, which is why I'm replacing him.
Too cautious?
You don't defend a burr by staying on the walls. Everything to the north of Manchester is pagan country. And they raid constantly. Tredian just watches them. He does nothing. I want a man who'll punish the pagans.
"'By invading Northumbria?' I asked sourly.
"'Seatrigger is king of that land in name only,' Æthelstan replied forcefully.
He saw me flinch at the uncomfortable truth and pressed his argument.
"'Does he have any burrs west of the hills?'
"'No,' I admitted.
Does he send men to punish evildoers? When he can, which is never, Æthelstan said scornfully. If the pagans of Northumbria raid Mercia, he went on, then we should punish them. Ingleland will be a country ruled by law, by Christian law.
Does Ingelmunder accept your law? I asked dubiously.
He does, Æthelstan said. He has submitted himself and his folk to my justice.
He ducked beneath the splintered branch of an alder. We were riding through a narrow belt of woodland that had been pillaged by the besiegers for firewood, and the trees bore the scars of their axes. Beyond the wood I could see the reed beds that edged the flat grey Mersey.
He has also welcomed our missionaries, Æthelstan added.
Of course he has, I responded.
Æthelstan laughed, his good humour restored.
We don't fight the Norsemen because they're newcomers, he said. We were newcomers ourselves once. We don't even fight them because they're pagans.
We were old pagans once.
We were indeed. No, we fight to bring them into our law. One country, one king, one law. If they break the law, we must impose it. But if they keep it, then we must live with them in peace.
Even if they're pagans?
By obeying the law, they will see the truth of Christ's commandments.
I wondered if this was why Æthelstan had demanded my company, to preach the virtues of Christian justice to me. Or was it to meet Ingelmunder, with whom he was so plainly impressed? For a time, as we rode along the Mersey's southern bank, he talked of his plans to strengthen Manchester, and then, impatient, he spurred his horse into a canter, leading me behind. Mudflats and reed beds stretched to my right, the water beyond almost still, just occasionally ruffled by a breath of wind. As we drew closer to the Burr, I saw that Æthelstan's flag still flew there, and two low, lean ships were safely tied at the wharf. It seemed Kinlaff's men had made no attempt to capture Brunanbuhr, which, as it turned out, had been garrisoned by a mere 30 men who opened the gates to welcome us. As I rode through the gate, I saw that Æthelstan had dismounted and was striding towards a tall young man who went to his knees as Æthelstan came close. Æthelstan raised him up, clasped the man's right arm with both hands, and turned to me.
"You must meet Ingelmunder," he exclaimed happily.
So this, I thought, was the Norse chieftain who had been allowed to settle so close to Chester. He was young, startlingly young, and strikingly handsome, with a straight blade of a nose and long hair that he wore tied in a leather lace, so that it hung almost to his waist.
"I asked Ingelmunder to meet us here," Æthelstan told me, "so we could thank him."
"Thank him for what?" I asked once I had dismounted.
"For not joining the rebellion, of course," Æthelstan said.
Ingelmunder waited as one of Æthelstan's men translated the words, then took a simple wooden box from one of his companions.
"It is a gift," he said, "to celebrate your victory. It is not much, Lord Prince, but it is much of all that we possess."
He knelt again and laid the box at Æthelstan's feet.
"We are glad, Lord Prince," he went on, "that your enemies are defeated."
"Without your help," I could not resist saying as Æthelstan listened to the translation.
"The strong do not need the help of the weak," Ingelmunder retorted.
He looked up at me as he spoke, and I was struck by the intensity of his blue eyes. He was smiling, he was humble, but his eyes were guarded. He had come with just four companions, and like them he wore plain breeches, a woolen shirt and a coat of sheepskin. No armour, no weapons. His only decorations were two amulets hanging at his neck. One, carved from bone, was Thor's hammer, while the other was a silver cross studded with jet. I had never seen any man display both tokens at once. Æthelstan raised the Norseman again.
"You must forgive the Lord Uhtred," he said. "He sees enemies everywhere."
"You
"Our Lord Uhtred?"
Ingelmunda said, and there was a flattering surprise and even awe in his voice. He bowed to me.
"I am honoured, Lord."
Ethelston gestured, and a servant came forward and opened the wooden box, which, I saw, was filled with hacksilver. The glittering scraps had been cut from torques and brooches, buckles and rings, most of them axe-hacked into shards that were used instead of coins. A merchant would weigh hacksilver to find its value, and Ingelmunda's gift, I thought grudgingly, was not paltry.
"You are generous," Ethelston said.
"We are poor, Lord Prince," Ingelmunda said, "but our gratitude demands we offer you a gift, however small."
And in his steadings, I thought, he was doubtless hoarding gold and silver. Why did Ethelston not see that? Perhaps he did, but his pious hopes of converting the pagans exceeded his suspicions.
"In an hour," he said to Ingelmunda, "we will have a service of thanksgiving in the hall. I hope you can attend, and I hope you will listen to the words Father Swithered will preach. In those words are eternal life."
"We shall listen closely, Lord Prince," Ingelmunda said earnestly,
and I wanted to laugh aloud. He was saying everything Ethelston wanted to hear, and though it was plain Ethelston liked the young Norseman, it was equally plain he did not see the slyness behind Ingelmunda's handsome face. He saw meekness, which the Christians ridiculously count as a virtue. The meek Ingelmunda sought me out after Swithred's interminable sermon, which I had not attended. I was on Brunanburh's wharf, idly gazing into the belly of a ship and dreaming of being at sea with the wind in my sail and a sword at my side, when I heard footsteps on the wooden planks and turned to see the Norseman. He was alone. He stood beside me and for a moment said nothing. He was as tall as I was. We both gazed into the moored ship, and after a long moment Ingelmunda broke our silence.
"Saxon ships are too heavy."
"Too heavy and too slow."
"My father had a Frisian ship once," he said, "and it was a beauty."
"You should persuade your friend Ethelston to give you ships," I said. "Then you can sail home." He smiled, despite my harsh tone.
"I have ships, Lord, but where is home? I thought Ireland was my home."
"Then go back there." He gave me a long look, as if weighing the depth of my hostility.
"You think I don't want to go back?" he asked. "I would, Lord, tomorrow, but Ireland is cursed. They're not men, they're fiends."
"They killed your father?" He nodded.
"They broke his shield wall."
"But you brought men away from the battle."
163 men and their families. 9 ships."
He sounded proud of that, and so he should have been. Retreating from a defeat is one of the hardest things to do in war, yet Ingelmunda, if he spoke truth, had fought his way back to the Irish shore. I could imagine the horror of that day. A broken shield wall, the shrieks of maddened warriors slaughtering their enemies, and the horsemen with their sharp spears racing in pursuit.
"You did well,"
I said, and looked down at his 2 amulets.
"Which god did you pray to?"
He laughed at that.
"To Thor, of course."
"Yet you wear a cross." He fingered the heavy silver ornament.
"It was a gift from my friend Ethelston. It would be churlish to hide it away."
"Your friend Ethelston," I said, mocking the word friend with my tone, "would like you to be baptized."
"He would, I know."
"And you keep his hopes alive?"
"Do I?"
he asked. He seemed amused by my questions.
"Perhaps his god is more powerful than ours. Do you care which god I worship, Lord Uhtred?"
"I like to know my enemies," I said. He smiled at that.
"I am not your enemy, Lord Uhtred."
"Then what are you? A loyal oath-follower of Prince Ethelston,
a settler pretending to be interested in the Saxon god.
"We are humble farmers now," he said. "Farmers and shepherds and fishermen."
"And I'm a humble goat-herd," I said. He laughed again.
"A goat-herd who wins his battles."
"I do," I said.
"Then let us make sure we are always on the same side," he said quietly.
He looked at the cross that crowned the prow of the nearest ship.
"I was not the only man driven out of Ireland," he said,
and something in his tone made me pay attention.
"Anlaf is still there, but for how long?"
"Anlaf?"
"He is the greatest chieftain of the Irish Norse, and he has strong fortresses. Even fiends find those walls deadly. Anlaf saw my father as a rival, and refused to help us, but that is not why we lost. My father lost the battle."
He gazed across the placid Mersey as he spoke.
"Because his brother and his men retreated before the fight. I suspect he was bribed with Irish gold."
"Your uncle?"
"He is called Skoll," he went on. "Skoll Grimason. Have you heard of him?"
"No."
"You will. He is ambitious, and he has a feared sorcerer."
He paused to touch the bone hammer.
"And he and his magician are in your country."
"In Northumbria?"
"Northumbria, yes. He landed north of here, far north, beyond the next river. What is it called?"
"The Ribble."
"Beyond the Ribble, where he has gathered men. Skoll, you see, craves to be called King Skoll."
"King of what?" I asked scornfully.
"Northumbria, of course. And that would be fitting, would it not? Northumbria, a northern kingdom for a Norse king."
He looked at me with his ice-blue eyes, and I remember thinking that Ingelmunder was one of the most dangerous men I had ever met.
"To become king, of course," he went on in a conversational tone. "He must first defeat Sitrygge, yes?"
"Yes. And he knows, who does not, that King Sitrygge's father-in-law is the renowned Lord Uhtred. If I were Skoll Grimason, I would want Lord Uhtred far from his home if I planned to cross the hills."
So this was why he had sought me out. He knew I had been lured across Britain, and he was telling me that his uncle, whom he plainly hated, had arranged the deception.
"And how," I asked, "would Skoll do that?" He turned to stare again at the river.
"My uncle has recruited men who settled south of the Ribble, and that, I'm told, is Mercian land."
"It is.
And my friend Æthelstan insists that all such settlers must pay tribute and must accept his missionaries."
I realized he was talking about the monk, Brother Osric, the man who had led me on a wild dance across the hills, the man who had lied to me. And Ingelmunder was telling me that his uncle, Skoll Grimason, had sent the monk on his treacherous errand.
"How do you know all this?" I asked. "Even we simple farmers like to know what is happening in the world."
"And even a simple farmer would like me to take revenge for his father's betrayal?"
"My Christian teachers tell me revenge is an unworthy thing."
"Your Christian teachers are full of shit," I said savagely. He just smiled.
"I almost forgot to tell you," he went on calmly, "that Prince Æthelstan asked that you should join him. I offered to carry the message. Shall we stroll back, Lord?"
That was the first time I saw Ingelmunder. In time I would meet him again, though in those later encounters he shone in mail, was hung with gold, and carried a sword called Bone Carver that was feared through all northern Britain. But on that day, by the Mersey, he did me a favour. The favour, of course, was in his interest. He wanted revenge on his uncle and was not yet strong enough to take that revenge himself. But the day would come when he would be strong.
strong, deadly, and clever. Æthelstan had said I would like him, and I did, but I also feared him. Æthelstan had requested that I accompany him to Brunanbuhr, and I had thought it was simply an opportunity for him to tell me about his hopes for Mercia and Inglaland, or perhaps to meet Ingelmunda, but it seemed there was another reason. He was waiting for me at the fort's gate, and when we joined him he beckoned for me to walk a small way eastwards. Ingelmunda left us alone. Four guards followed us, but stayed well out of earshot. I sensed that Æthelstan was nervous. He commented on the weather, on his plans to rebuild Chester's Bridge, on his hopes for a good spring planting, on anything, it seemed, rather than the purpose of our meeting. "What did you think of Ingelmunda?" he asked when we had exhausted the prospects of harvest. "He's clever," I said.
"Just clever?"
"Vain," I said. "Untrustworthy and dangerous." Æthelstan seemed shocked by that answer.
"I count him as a friend," he said stiffly, "and I hoped you would too."
"Why?"
"He's proof we can live together in peace."
"He still wears Thor's hammer."
"So do you, but he is learning better. He's eager for the truth, and he has enemies among the other Norse, and that could make him a friend to us, a good friend."
"You sent him missionaries?" I asked.
"Two priests, yes. They tell me he is earnest in his search for truth."
"I want to know about your other missionaries," I went on. "Those you sent to the Norse who settled south of the Ribble." He shrugged.
"We sent six, I believe. They're brothers."
"You mean monks, black monks?"
"They are Benedictines, yes."
"And did one of them have a scar across his tonsure?"
"Yes."
Æthelstan stopped and looked at me, puzzled, but offered him no explanation for my question.
"Brother Beardwolf has that scar," he told me. "He tells me he had an argument with his sister when he was a child, and he likes to say she gave him his first tonsure."
"She should have slit his throat," I said, "because I'm going to tear his belly open from his crotch to his breastbone."
"God forgive you!"
Æthelstan sounded horrified.
"They already call you the priest-killer."
"Then they can call me monk-killer, too," I said, "because your brother Beardwolf is my brother Osric." Æthelstan flinched.
"You can't be sure," he said uncertainly.
I ignored his words. "Where did you send brother Beardwolf, or whatever he's called?"
"To a man called Arnborg."
"Arnborg?"
"A Norse chieftain who once held land on Monnes. He was driven out by the Welsh and settled on the coast north of here. He leads maybe 100 men. I doubt he has more than 100.
"How far north?"
"He came to the Ribble with 3 ships and found land on the southern bank of the river. He swore to keep the peace and pay us tribute."
Æthelstan looked troubled.
"The monk is a tall man, yes? Dark hair?"
"And with a scar that looked as if someone had opened up his head from one ear to the other. I wish they had."
"It sounds like Brother Beardwolf,"
Æthelstan admitted unhappily. "And I'm going to find him," I said.
"If it is Brother Beardwolf,"
Æthelstan said, recovering his poise,
"then perhaps he just wanted to help, wanted the siege lifted."
"So he lies to me about his name, lies about where he's from?" Æthelstan frowned.
"If Brother Beardwolf has transgressed, then he must suffer Mercian justice."
"Transgressed?" I mocked the word.
"He is a Mercian," Æthelstan insisted, "and while he is on Mercian soil, I forbid you to harm him. He may be in error, but he is a man of God, and therefore under my protection."
"Then protect him," I said savagely, "from me." Æthelstan bridled at that, but held his temper.
"You may deliver him to me for judgment," he said.
"I am capable, Lord Prince," I said, still savage, "of dispensing my own justice."
"Not," he said sharply, "inside Mercia. Here you are under my father's authority."
He hesitated, then added,
"And mine."
"My authority," I snarled, "is this." I slapped Serpent Breath's hilt. "And on that authority, Lord Prince, I am riding to find Jarl Arnborg."
"And Brother Beedwulf?"
"Of course." He stood straighter, confronting me. "And if you kill another man of God," he said, "you become my enemy."
For a moment I had no idea what to say, and for the same moment I was tempted to tell him to stop being a pompous little arsling. I had known him and protected him since he was a child. He had been like a son to me, but in the last few years the priests had got to him. Yet the boy I had nurtured was still there, I thought, and so I suppressed my anger.
"You forget," I said, "that I swore an oath to the Lady Ethelfled to protect you, and I will keep that oath."
"What else did you swear to her?" he asked.
"To serve her, and I did."
"You did?"
he agreed.
"You served her well, and she loved you."
He turned away, staring at the bare low branches of bog myrtle that grew in a damp patch beside a ditch.
"You remember how the Lady Ethelfled liked bog myrtle? She believed the leaves kept fleas away."
He smiled at the memory.
"And you remember this ditch, Lord?"
"I remember it. You killed Erdwulf here."
"I did. I was just a boy. I had bad dreams for weeks afterwards. So much blood. To this day, when I smell bog myrtle, I think of blood in a ditch. Why did you make me kill him?"
"Because a king must learn the cost of life and death."
"And you want me to be king after my father?"
"No, Lord Prince," I said, surprising him. "I want Elfweird to be king because he's a useless piece of weasel shit, and if he invades Northumbria, I'll gut him. But if you ask me who ought to be king..."
"You, of course." "And you once took an oath to protect me," he said quietly.
"I did, to the Lady Ethelfled, and I kept that oath."
"You did keep it," he agreed.
He was staring into the ditch where some skims of ice still lingered.
"I want your oath, Lord Uhtred," he said.
So that was why he had summoned me. No wonder he had been nervous. He turned his head to look at me, and I saw the determination in his face. He had grown up. He was no longer a boy or even a youth. He had become as stern and unbending as Alfred, his grandfather.
"My oath?" I asked, because I was not sure what else to say. "I want the same oath you gave to the Lady Ethelfled," he said calmly.
"I swore to serve her," I said.
"I know."
I owed Ethelstan. He had been beside me when we recaptured Bebbanburg, and he had fought well there, even though he had no need to be in that fight. So, yes, I owed him. But did he know he was asking the impossible? We live by oaths, and we can die by them. To give an oath is to harness a life to a promise, and to break an oath is to tempt the punishment of the gods. "I swore loyalty to King Sigtryggr," I said, "and I cannot break that oath. How can I serve both you and him?"
"You can swear an oath," he said, "that you will never oppose me, never thwart me.
And if you invade Northumbria,
then you will not fight me."
"And my oath to my son-in-law?" I asked. "If," I paused, "when you invade Northumbria, my oath to Sigtryggr means I must oppose you. You would want me to break that oath."
"It is a pagan oath," he said, "and therefore meaningless."
"Like the oath you took from Ingelmunda?" I asked, and he had no reply to that. "My oath to Sigtryggr ruled my life, Lord Prince." I spoke his title with condescension. "I swore to the Lady Ethelfled that I would protect you, and I will. And if you fight Sigtryggr, I will keep that oath by doing my best to capture you in battle and not kill you." I shook my head.
No, Lord Prince, I will not swear to serve you.
I am sorry, he said.
And now, Lord Prince, I went on, I am riding to find Brother Osric. Unless, of course, you choose to stop me. He shook his head.
I will not stop you.
I watched him walk away. I was angry that he had asked for my oath. He should have known me better. But then I told myself he was growing into his authority, that he was testing it. And I was pursuing Arnborg. Ingelmunder had told me that his uncle, Skoll Grimason, had received the allegiance of Norsemen settled south of the Ribble, and I assumed Arnborg was one of those men. And Arnborg had sheltered Brother Osric, Brother Beardwolf, who had lied to me. I wanted to know why, and I suspected that Brother Beardwolf, after leaving us at Manchester, would have gone back to Arnborg's steading. So to find the monk, I needed to go north. I needed to go into the wildlands. We did not leave at once. We could not. Our horses needed more rest, a half dozen of the beasts were lame, and even more required reshoeing. So we waited 3 days, then left to go north, though the first part of our journey took us east, towards the brine pits that soured the land around the River Weaver. Great fires burned where men boiled the brine in iron vats, and where salt made heaps like snowdrifts. The Romans, of course, had made the salt works, or at least had expanded them so they could supply all Britain with salt. And to make that easy, they had embanked a road across the water meadows, raising it on a great causeway of gravel. I had scouts ranging ahead, though there was small need of them on the wide, flat plain across which the road ran like a spear. I expected no trouble, though only a fool travelled Britain's roads without taking precautions. In places we passed through thick woodland, and it was possible that stragglers from Kinlaf's forces might be looking for unarmed travellers, but no hungry or desperate men would dare attack my men, who wore mail and helmets and were armed with swords. But hungry, desperate men might have attacked our companions, who were 18 women on their way to establish the convent that Æthelstan wanted in Manchester, and a dozen merchants who had been stranded in Chester by the siege. The merchants in turn had servants who led pack horses laden with valuable goods, tanned hides, silverware from Gloucester, and fine spearheads forged in London. One pack horse carried the corpse of a man who had followed Kinlaf. The head was separately wrapped in canvas, and both head and body would be nailed to Manchester's main gate as a warning to others tempted to rebel against King Edward's rule. Æthelstan, his manner cold and distant after I had refused to give him my oath, had asked me to protect the merchants, pack-horses, nuns, and corpse all the way to Manchester. "I'm not going that far," I told him.
"You're going to the Ribble," he had pointed out. "Going by Manchester is your easiest route."
"I don't want the settlers on the Ribble to know I'm coming," I said, "which means I can't use the roads." Roman roads would lead us to Manchester, and another road left that fortress and went north to Ribblecaster, a Roman fort on the Ribble. Following such roads made travel easy. There was little chance of getting lost in endless tracts of wooded hills, and at least in the larger settlements there were barns to sleep in, smithies to shoe horses, and taverns accustomed to feeding travellers. But Arnborg, who I suspected might have occupied the old Roman fort at Ribblecaster, would have men watching the road. So I planned to approach him from the west, through land settled by Norsemen.
"The nuns need protection,"
Æthelstan had protested. "So protect them," I had said. And so 22 of Æthelstan's spearmen rode to guard the travellers on the last part of their journey. Sungifu was one of the women.
"What I don't understand," I said to her, "is why you need a convent in Manchester."
"Nuns are needed everywhere, Lord Uhtred," she said.
"Manchester," I said, "is a frontier burr. All the land around it is pagan, nasty and dangerous. Like you."
I looked down at her. I had offered her one of my spare horses, but she had refused, claiming that Jesus' disciples had walked everywhere, so she and the sisters should do the same. "I'm nasty," I asked. She just smiled. She was so breathtakingly beautiful, even in a dark grey habit, with a cowl covering her startling fair hair. "You'd better hope I am nasty," I told her, "because that will keep you safe."
"Jesus keeps me safe, Lord."
"Jesus will be no damned use to you if a Danish warband comes out of that wood." I nodded towards a stretch of leafless trees to the east, and thought of Abbess Hild, my friend now in far-off Wintonchester, who had been raped repeatedly by Guthrum's Danes. "It's a cruel world, Mus," I said, using her old nickname, "and you have to hope the warriors defending you are just as cruel as your enemies."
"Are you cruel, Lord?"
"I'm good at war," I told her, "and war is cruel." She looked ahead to where Æthelstan's horsemen rode.
"Will they be enough to protect us?"
"How many other travellers have you seen on this road?" I asked. We were going north, entering low hills and leaving the wide, flat plain with its lazy rivers behind us.
"Not many," she said.
"Just three today," I said. "And why? Because this is dangerous country. It's mostly Danish with just a few Saxons. Until Edward made his burr at Manchester, it was ruled by a Dane, and that was only 2 years ago. Now that country is being settled by Norsemen. I think it's madness sending you to Manchester."
"Then why won't you protect us all the way?"
"Because 22 warriors are enough to keep you safe," I said confidently, "and because I have urgent business somewhere else and it will be quicker for me to cut across country." I was tempted to escort the nuns all the way to Manchester, but the temptation was solely because of Mus. I wondered about her. When she had been married to Bishop Leofstan, she had whored enthusiastically, but Æthelstan had been certain she was a reformed sinner. Maybe she was, but I did not like to ask her.
"What will you do in Manchester?" I asked instead. "Maybe I'll take my vows."
"Why haven't you taken them yet?"
"I don't feel worthy, Lord."
I gave her a sceptical look. "Prince Æthelstan believes you're the holiest woman he knows."
"And the prince is a good man, Lord, a very good man," she said, smiling. "But he doesn't know women very well."
Something in her tone made me look at her again, but her face was all innocence, so I ignored her remark. "So, what will you do in Manchester?" I asked instead.
"Pray," she said,
and I made a scornful sound.
"And heal the sick, Lord."
She gave me her dazzling smile.
"And what's your business, Lord, that makes you abandon me?"
"I have to kill a monk," I told her, and to my surprise she laughed. We left them next morning, striking west into wooded hills. I had not been truthful with Mus. Our quickest route was to follow the convenient Roman roads, but I needed to approach Charnborg's settlement without being discovered, and that meant cutting across the country, finding our way by instinct and by the sun. I doubled my scouts. We were entering land where the Danish had been reinforced by Norse settlers, where few Saxons survived, land that had been claimed by Mercia but never occupied by Mercian troops. Manchester, the nearest burr, had been made deep in this land, a defiant gesture by Edward that claimed that he was king of all the country south of the burr, but many of the people here had not even heard of Edward. The land was rich but sparsely settled. There were no villages. In southern Mercia and in Wessex, which was now supposedly all one kingdom, there were settlements of cottages, usually built around a church and with no defensive palisade, but here what dwellings existed were almost all behind strong timber walls. We avoided them.
We ate hard cheese, stale bread, and smoked herrings that Ethelstan's steward had given us from his storehouses. We carried forage bags for the horses because the spring grass was still weak.